Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who just came straight from the UN General Assembly, where he made his first address ever, Rick Hess!
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
I'm well. How about yourself?
Oof, pretty good. That UN, that is a rough bunch.
Yeah, Rick, why'd you decide to go into education, domestic policy, instead of foreign policy? I would think Frederick M. Hess, that sounds like a kind of a foreign policy person.
Hey, thank you. Thank you.
Was there Frederick Kagan? Is that one of the big names?
Over at AEI. Well, look at you.
Yeah.
You're becoming more erudite every day, baby.
Do the Frederick AEI Fredericks hang out together?
We do. We've got a little corner.
Uh-huh.
We call it the Fredericks Lounge.
Yeah.
We got a little Dotson we call Fredrickson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Okay. I'm looking for a pun.
You guys all live for a pun and coming up empty, baby. You guys all live in Frederick, Maryland?
Oh!
So, speaking of AI, Irving Kristol passed away this week. And have there been celebrations over at AI to mark his life and his accomplishments?
What celebrations and...
Sadness. Yes.
But, for those folks who don't follow this kind of stuff, he was just an enormously influential thinking in terms of shaping modern conservative thought on domestic policy in particular, and of course a famous hawk from the Cold War era, and he was an enormously influential guy at AEI. He's on the, he played an advisory role and a contributing role for decades.
Did you ever get to meet him and interact with him?
Met him a little bit, I think everything that I've written he had thought about and decided wasn't that interesting 35, 40 years ago. So, his wife, Gertrude Himmelfarb, herself, a heavy hitter. And they've been around AEI, consistently. And so they've got a lot of personal friends, who are incredibly sad.
Okay. Well, we have a lot to cover today, Rick. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly with Mickey NPR Muldoon at the helm. Then we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. Stafford's going to rate that reform. We got the full cast here today. Let's get going.
All right, question one. The new draft of the Common Core Standards in Math and Reading, Writing, Speaking, Listening were released this week with little fanfare. Where and when are the real political and cultural battles going to pop up in the national standards movement?
Mike? What do you think, Bip?
Well, it's a little fanfare. It got a Washington Post article. That's something, right? One? Was that it? Is that all? That's all? The only people that care about this whole thing?
I think, on the other hand, any time the race to the top emits a belch, they get a Washington Post article. So.
Yes. All right. That's true. First of all, this is another significant milestone. We now have real live draft standards that are national standards, even though they don't like to use that terminology. But it won't matter until these things are final, until some states start to adopt them. So we know we got a long ways to go. Here's where I see this going. I don't see a lot of debate around the math standards. Seems like people from all persuasions seem to like the math standards. So perhaps we've come to the end of the math wars, and we've got some math standards that really are going to get in place and could be national standards in math, which is a good thing. I think there's a lot more debate around these reading, writing, speaking, and listening standards that, by the way, are not called English language arts standards, and they shouldn't be, because they really are skills standards. They don't involve content. They don't talk about kids learning literature, per se. And I think this is where you're going to have some big debate. And, there's still the potential that there could be some culture war fallout from that down the road.
Yeah. I mean, right. One problem is that we are going to be enormously excited. People are going to be enormously chatty about how neat it is if these things get adopted and embraced formally by NGA or something. But, of course, that's about 10% of the battle. The other 90% is to see what the textbook publishers actually do, mm-hmm. how the assessments are actually reconfigured, mm-hmm. how these are actually implemented and used in the states. But, of course, that's going to be the boring part of the story, which will unfold more or less invisibly, mm-hmm. which means we will get it all wrong. In the shorter term, the trick here is to get standards that cover the essential but aren't aspirational and overly expansive. And it's going to be real interesting to see. On the math front, one way to get folks to like them is you throw everything in there, and then everybody says, oh, how challenging and fascinating. But I'm not sure how usefully those will be in terms of instruction.
My understanding is that they did a pretty good job on math and keeping them, within bounds.
We'll see.
The question on English, and reading, not English, is this question about content. And whether we're going to have curricula and standards and textbooks and tests, even at the high school level, that are about reading skills instead of about reading great works of literature, that's going to make a lot of people nervous, myself included. Topic number two.
Maryland recently discovered that only 11 out of more than 60,000 seniors did not graduate last year because they failed the graduation exam. State Superintendent of Schools Nancy Grasmick commented, quote, "Now that we've achieved a floor, I think the next step is to raise the standards." So how do you do all that without all but ensuring that more students fail next time?
Yeah, we've seen this movie before. In the 1970s, there's something called the minimum skills test.
Competencies, right?
Minimum competency tests, I guess. And initially, 20-25% of kids and various early adopters were failing. But the great triumph was by the early 1980s, only a tiny fraction of 1% of kids were not passing the exams. And of course, that showed that we had actually solved the challenge of making sure that all of our high schools were mastering basic. You know, we have now, after a quarter century, because everybody's forgotten about that, we've gone through this exactly again. After years of pushing and pulling, Maryland has come up with a testing regime, which between the silliness of the tests, the silliness of the expectations, and all the loopholes, guarantee that they don't actually mean anything. Woohoo!
You know, yes, she says that perhaps it's time to raise the standard. Well, that's a politically bold move when you've got, what, 14 kids in the entire state?
11.
Failing.
11.
11.
11. 11. And, you know, and I mean, they're, frankly, that would point exactly opposite what we've seen the last 6-7 years in Maryland, mm-hmm. which has been a constant ratcheting downward.
That's right.
So that you would get the number down to 11.
See, they have finally reached the floor, and it's time to start working back up again.
Right.
All right, topic number three.
A recent New York Times article described the awful state of South African schools. There's rampant teacher absenteeism despite the highest teacher unionization rate in the world, no accountability, little power for principals, and achievement scores below some far poorer African peers. In the face of all this, Jacob Zuma is considering giving the education ministry more control over principal selection and principals more control over their schools. Is this a formula for better discipline, for authoritarianism, or for both? And is there a role for private schools like the kind described in James Tooley's book, The Beautiful Tree?
Well, that's a lot of questions, Mickey.
Well, it's two, really.
And I got to admit, I mean, I don't know anything about South African education other than what I read in that New York Times article, which is depressing and yet also strangely made me feel a little bit better about our own education system.
How so?
Just that, you know, we're not the only ones with this horrible problem. Look, you know, I, as I've indicated on the show before, I'm working on a book and I've been diving into the peer effects literature about diverse schools, the effects of concentrating poor and poor minority kids into schools together. Sounds like in South Africa, you've had that same issue. You've got these schools that were designed in the apartheid area to be bad schools where most of the black students go, and they still go there, and they're still there with just other poor black students for the most part. And so we shouldn't be surprised that those schools are not getting very good results.
Wait a minute, though. But, I mean, don't we have high poverty, 100% minority schools in the U.S.? I'm thinking KIPP or Achievement First that are actually doing pretty well.
Yeah, we have like 200 or 300 of those out of 100,000 schools.
Oh, doesn't South Africa just need some high-quality charters?
That's right. I think that's, you know, maybe once KIPP and all the rest are done with the scaling up innovation with the I-3 program here, they can go to South Africa. Yeah. Okay, now it is time for everyone's favorite. It is Amber's Research Minute. You know, Rick, talking about that KIPP point, I for the book, I was doing a little calculations trying to think about how much these schools need to scale up. You know, people seem to say, okay, if you count KIPP and Achievement First and a few of these others, you got maybe 200 or 300 charter schools that are really knocking it out of the park. You know, you add up how many kids they're serving. I mean, it's maybe the size of a small school district, right? Maybe 50,000 kids, I figured. So we got 20 million poor kids in the country eligible for free or reduced price lunch. So let's say we want KIPP and their partners to serve just a quarter of those kids, just a quarter. They have to grow 100 times over.
Mm-hmm.
100 times. That's a lot of scaling up.
No, it's funny. I was doing exactly this one back of my envelope. Richard Barth and I were doing an event up in New York last month, and we got into this conversation with the journalists about KIPP's growth projection, right? And KIPP's aggressive growth model is getting up to maybe 500 schools by the end of the next, you know, 10, 20 years. I mean, right, 20 years out, 2030. Mm-hmm. And KIPP at 500 schools is serving less than 1% of low-income Latino and African-American youth. I mean, so the notion that we can, you know, even aggressive growth with these same models, kind of using the same tools they've got, is going to get us where we want to be, is, I think, you know, maybe that'll get us where we want by 60-14 or 70-14. Mm-hmm. But we need to be aware of the limits of the, you know, relying too heavily on this course.
Of course, by then we might have been invaded by aliens that know how to figure this problem out.
Or if we're living in huts under alien occupation, we might have bigger problems.
that's another good point. Okay, all that said, people want to hear Amber's Research Minute. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Thank you so much. All right. We have this week a new rigorous charter school study out by Carolyn Hoxby that uses a lottery-based analysis. This means that since charter schools are oversubscribed, the vast majority of charter school applicants are randomly divided into a lotteried in-group that attend charter schools and a lotteried out-group that remain in the traditional schools. This way, the groups are equal on a bunch of measures that we typically can't measure, like student motivation and family interest in education. Anyway, the study finds that students who were enrolled in charter schools from grades kindergarten through eighth in New York City scored roughly 30 points higher on the state math exam than their counterparts who'd been lotteried out and remained in the traditional school. In English language arts, the lotteried in-group still outperformed the lotteried out-group, but by a lesser margin of about 23 points. On average, though, a lotteried out student who stays in the traditional school for grades K to 8 remains on grade level and performs a bit better than a disadvantaged students nationwide. So, all in all, compelling data from a study with more rigorous methods than those used in the Credo charter study a couple months ago. But we need to keep in mind that New York charters are not representative of charters in other states.
Boom. Very tight, right on the money in terms of time. Okay, so I just want to show off a little bit of my recent learning here.
Go ahead, I'm loving it.
Carolyn Hoxby, a phenomenal economist. I try to read her papers, and I have to skip over about 80% of them because they've got these little squiggly lines and stuff. Mm. I don't know what those things are. Carolyn Hoxby, she is an expert on voucher research like this one. She's also an expert on this peer review effect stuff. Nice. So let's play this out. All right. So we know that this is a fair comparison where we're taking kids who applied to the lottery and got in, kids who applied to the lottery and didn't get in. However, all the kids that applied to the lottery, you've got to expect are more motivated, their parents are more motivated. There's something special about these kids that they're trying so hard to get into these charter schools, right? Now you're comparing similar kids, but one kid gets to go to a charter school where all the other kids come from these motivated families too, and the other kid stays behind in a school with not as motivated parents. So why should we be surprised that these charter schools are getting bigger, better results? Boom.
Look at you, baby.
What study design would you suggest, Mike?
I'm just saying.
But this is actually the terrific point here. I mean, Carolyn's study here is, you know, it's terrific. Mm-hmm. Right, this tells us a ton about the benefits of these children getting to go to these New York charter schools and not. And I find it, you know, persuasive that these kids are better off going to charter schools, which is terrific. But there's at least two considerations here. One is that charter schooling is not an intervention. It's not like a reading program. A charter school in New York City is not the same thing as a charter school in Dayton, Ohio, or a charter school in Western Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the second thing is, to Mike's point, that because all of the students we are choosing from have these shared characteristics, we want to be similarly careful about generalizing from what works for them and simply assuming that it will work for everyone or work for everyone in different circumstances. What this really points to is not anything that was done wrong here.
Study,
this is a terrific study.
Right.
But it points to the limitations of even gold standard research in trying to wrestle with big, thorny questions about structural reform.
Yeah, sure. And what I would say is, look, let's be honest that a lot of these charter schools are doing a phenomenal job. And what they're doing is they're allowing high potential, high achieving, motivated kids to come together and be around other high potential, high achieving, motivated kids. They're poor, they're minority, but they have those special characteristics and they're getting great results. Mm-hmm. And we should celebrate that. That is good for our country, our society. That means more kids that come from these neighborhoods are going to be prepared to go to college. Mm-hmm. But let's call it a talent development program, a talent search program.
Or if you're Tom Loveless, let's call it tracking.
That's right. We're tracking by school. And call it creaming, call it whatever you want, and let's not be ashamed of it. Let's not say that means we know, because we know this works for those kids, now we know how to fix it.
Well, one of the arguments here is that it's high poverty kids who suffer worse from detracking, arguably, because of instead of getting to be clustered with other motivated students in particular classrooms, they wind up in schools where the most students are not necessarily engaged in that way, and they suffer. And what you're suggesting is, rather than track them by classrooms, one of the phenomena we're seeing is we're tracking them at the school level, which has stronger effects for them but poses a whole bunch of challenges to the folks who want to argue that detracking is a recipe broadly.
Mm-hmm. Now, oh, go ahead, Amber.
Well, I was just going to say, in the peer effects literature, you know, is showing that, you know, these high-performing, I mean, these low-performing kids bring down, you know, their peers no matter what achievement level they are. So
that's right.
Anyway.
So, and high achievers are particularly benefited from the boutique model of being around other high achievers.
That's right.
How do you like
the
that?
The boutique model.
Ah, nice.
Got the phrase.
Yeah, well, you seem proud of me. I like
I love that.
That.
So, what's the tune here?
The tune, since we've got charter school students appearing to do so well in the study and the lotteried out students not doing so well, we have ABBA's Winner Takes It All.
That's a great song, Amber.
Isn't that a great song?
It is.
And that was Laura's pick. I love it.
Laura, well done.
Why are we whispering?
Out of reverence for ABBA. But out of reverence for Rate That Reform, let's hear this snazzy music. See, now,
Rick, I've never heard that before, you know, because I don't have my mic, you know.
That's right. Rick had to leave. Amber, you know, gets to stay in her seat with the earphones on, and she was doing the head bob.
I love the snazzy.
To the music.
I've never heard it. I like it.
It's good, isn't it?
We'll pet to the end of the show.
That's right. All right, staff, we're going strong. Bring us across the finish line now. What are we rating?
Okay, today we are rating, well, I'll just dive right into it. In this tough economy, it is hard to hold down just one job, let alone two. That is, if you are not Raquel Downing, former assistant principal at a middle school in the Bronx and now occupant of one of the infamous rubber rooms in New York City. Ooh. She was fired for insubordination from her position in 2005, appealed the decision, and she's now been sitting in a rubber room for 4 years as her particularly tangled mess of litigation continues. All of this on a $100,000 salary and benefits. But that's not all. Downing also operates an internet business, selling CDs for children, all from two laptops and a couple of Blackberries, which she wields from the comfort of her rubber room assignment center.
Nice.
Downing has even turned down a job that would have gotten her out of rubber room exile. And though her double dipping is illegal, the district can't get rid of her because of the city's due process rules, and Downing continues to draw two paychecks. I don't even know where to start on this one. I mean, we could just talk about how stupid rubber rooms are in general, but since that would sort of be a large topic, let's talk about the fact that the city can't regulate the rubber rooms. The fact that we've got people in rubber rooms who are participating in entrepreneurial activity on the city's paycheck is obviously not in the financial interests of any party, except maybe Raquel Downing. So I gave this one an F.
Wow. Now, and you can see, I mean, the solutions to this, let's say you tried to like have some kind of blackout zone on internet access in the room. Well, some of these rubber room people are already complaining that the rubber room is just like Guantanamo. You
know. Oh, yes. Or Mao's concentration camps.
Yes. So you can only imagine, you know, we try to like, but you got to say from, what was her name? Raquel?
Raquel.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, from her perspective, I mean, what, you've got nothing to lose.
Yeah. And everybody else is knitting, doing crossword puzzles. Yeah. She's making a buck.
That's
know?
Right. I mean, in some ways, I have to say, this is kind of good old-fashioned American entrepreneurialism. I mean, she's not being idle, at least. If her case, finally, they determine that she gets canned and she's gone through the process, I mean, does she have to pay back any of this money she's earned from sitting in the rubber room?
I don't think so.
They get to keep it?
It's unclear.
I don't think
so.
I
imagine that they would have to repay it.
They
back.
Just get to keep it.
Yep. I think that she just, you know, gets her salary, and then if she gets canned, she gets canned, and she gets I mean, honestly, based on the system, she probably gets a termination bonus for getting canned.
What I love is the reporter like emailed her, you know, requesting a CD, and lickety split, she emailed right back.
The reporter posed
as a customer
during business hours when Raquel should have been in the rubber room, and Raquel responded
right back.
Well, Amber, it's a pleasure having you with us through the end of the show. And but that is all the time we have. So until next week.
I'm Stafford Palmieri.
I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net. Signing off.